Justify. Prove to be right or reasonable. Justification is at the heart of all legal and political argument. But at a time when argument itself is slave to appearances, it is time to bring back a culture of justification. Justify, a podcast on law and politics in India from the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, hosted by Orgho Sengupta.
Welcome to another episode of Justify. As India prepares to go to the polls, this season is dedicated to examining issues of law and policy which shape our nation.
I'm delighted that all of you could be here today to hear an extremely interesting and timely discussion on decoding defection. Defection is a malaise that affects Indian politics, and I'm certain we will see it rear its ugly head again in a few months' time. And who better to dissect the law of defection for us than Dr. Abhishek Manu Singhvi? We're honored, Dr. Singhvi, that you could be with us today. Please join me in welcoming him. Dr. Singhvi, of course, needs no introduction. He's a super senior advocate. You can't just call him a senior advocate, a super senior advocate in the Supreme Court, a constitutional scholar, an eminent jurist, a member of the Congress Working Committee. I could go on with his list of achievements and positions. I could also have said that he has been an MP for 18 years. I would have loved to say that he continues to be one, but it is defections that means that he is today firmly ensconced within the legal fraternity. So what I can say is that Parliament's loss is the legal profession's gain. Thank you very much, Dr. Singhvi, for coming here today. So without any further ado, let's jump right into defection. We all know of the Aya Ram, Gaya Ram syndrome, which was about Gaya Lal, who in 1967 crossed parties twice in the same day and then four times in the next 2 weeks. This was the first elections in Haryana that happened. But unfortunately, this is not a one-off instance, and it set a real precedent which we can see sadly repeat itself every time there are any elections in India, particularly those which result in hung parliaments or hung legislatures. In response to this, we had the 10th schedule, which was brought into the Constitution by the 52nd Amendment. The purpose of the 10th schedule was to check defections by ensuring that those who defect get disqualified. But there is widespread consensus that the 10th schedule has not worked. Why is that so? This is one key question that we'll be discussing, and also the larger question as to whether an issue of political morality, such as defection, can it really be solved by law? Now, Dr. Singhvi has appeared in a number of seminal judgments to do with defection, most recently in the Maharashtra case. And so let me start with that and the question of delays. You appeared in the Subhash Desai versus the Maharashtra State Legislative Assembly case. For all of you, you remember, in short, Eknath Shinde crossed over. Eknath Shinde continues to remain Chief Minister of Maharashtra State. And one of the things that we saw that emerged in that case, but happens regularly, is the question of delay. When the speaker has before him or her a disqualification petition that belongs to its own party, then there is always a delay in deciding that disqualification petition. When it is on the other side, then this matter is decided very quickly. So how do you see this question of delay, both in the Maharashtra case and more generally? Dr. Singhvi.
Thank you, Argya. And I must tell you that Argya and his institution has for the first time brought into India a degree of professionalism in legal drafting, which was teetering on the brink of extinction after having very hallowed standards in the 60s and the 50s when some of our top legal brains used to be draftsmen. Now, Vidhi is doing excellent work, and I wish more competitors to people like him emerge in India, because it helps a lot if you have laws and lesser litigation because of clarity. Secondly, I think Argya has, been a little polite. Perhaps I now realize that the most important qualification for inviting me was as a victim of defection. I just realized it sitting here, having spent 3 terms in Parliament. This is a unique qualification regarding disqualification. But let's start with this first question, delay. Now, before that, I must tell you, I've had the privilege, and you should discount everything I say. I've won many, I've lost some. I've had the privilege of appearing in almost every major case to deal with not only defection in the narrower sense, but the larger issue of toppling governments, defection, because they are connected. 356, presidents rule. They are all, in a sense, constitutionally connected issues. And starting from Uttarakhand to Jharkhand in the old days, even before Uttarakhand, then, of course, two Karnataks, including the midnight hearing in Karnataka. Then two Maharashtras, one Madhya Pradesh. So it's been a long journey, and I never realized that I would be ultimately a victim of one in Himachal Pradesh. So it's really coming full circle, both as a lawyer, as a public life person, and as a theoretician. So this is the most pragmatic aspect of defections I've seen this time. Now, about this question on delay, of course, my general view is that this whole system is flawed. The 10th schedule should be scrapped. Maybe we'll discuss this later on the larger issue. But on the narrower question of delay, it is but natural. I mean, common sense should tell you that if I am the speaker belonging to the same party as the complainant, alternatively, if I am the speaker belonging to a party opposing the complainant, how can you expect objectivity? So there are cases now with remarkable facts, and I don't want to bore you with details. There's a case I did, which is not reported from that point of view, from Tamil Nadu, where the speaker delayed and delayed and delayed because the party to which he belonged was the ruling party, a decision on a complaint of clear defection. Then our side, who was opposing, went to the High Court. The High Court gave a very grandiloquent set of, you know, rhetorical sentences saying this should not be, this should be. At the end said, look, we can't give directions to the speaker. So we are sending you back to the speaker with the hope and expectation the speaker will decide soon. The speaker, of course, never decided. So we went to challenge the High Court judgment in the Supreme Court. Look at the ladder. And all the time is passing. Supreme Court finally said the speaker should decide soon. The speaker took another 3 to 4 months and decided, by which time the term was almost over of the entire House. Now, this is a very live, real example. It shows, Indian jugaad at its best. We are geniuses in, you know, the text of the law, the structure can always be distorted. It finally, fortunately, found a judgment in Manipur. Manipur is the reported judgment where a judge who's one of the most brilliant jurists we've had, and he was very forthright and direct, Justice Rohinton Nariman, said, look, this is all nonsense. If you don't come back and decide, then we'll give a direction that this shall be decided by somebody else or that it shall be deemed to be disqualified. At which, after 9 months delay, the Manipur speaker woke up. In that judgment, however, Justice Nariman has given a broad timeline. I don't remember. I think it's 3 months.
3 months.
3 months
for speaker.
As the right paradigm for decision making. Unfortunately, it's only a suggestion. Justice Nariman gave a very good alternative suggestion. He said, this whole system is bunkum. You create a regulatory commission to decide these matters. Now, since he could at best, even the Supreme Court, give a suggestion, a recommendation, a guideline, it is frequently observed in the breach. 3 months is like that provision in the 1951 Representation of People's Act that all election petitions should be decided in 6 months. Actually, hardly any election petition I know of is decided in 6 years even.
Yeah, most judges don't like to.
So,
like to,
you know, the jugaad in the election petition arena is that you delay to the whole term of the election petition, after which it becomes infructuous.
That's right.
Unless it's a corrupt practice. So these are areas where, you know, sermonizing and didactism has its limitations. But yes, you have now a direct guideline of 3 months being the correct paradigm.
So there was a very interesting line that Dr. Singhvi had in his recent Indian Express article, which is that constitutional law is no match for Indian jugaad. And I think this is what is happening with defection time and again. But before we get into some of the intricacies of the law, as a general matter, there is one misconception which I would like you to clarify. And that misconception is about splits and mergers. And even in the Shinde case, there was this misconception that if 2/3 of the party moved over, then in that case, it's quite all right. And of course, we all know as constitutional lawyers that The split provision in the 10th schedule has been repealed. It doesn't exist. But the merger exemption still continues. But could you clarify the law for us so that everybody knows what the position is as far as this two-thirds rule is concerned?
You're absolutely right. This is a permanent, it's a continuous misconception, mostly in the minds of lawyers as well, leave aside laypersons. You see, the law started when it was drafted, because they did it bona fide. They felt that, look, if more than one-third express something, then you should have an exit route. So there's the original one-third rule, or rather not one-third, it was a split rule, that you have a recognition of a split. All that melted away by a subsequent constitutional amendment when they found that this is being abused. So they've drafted a provision which is much misunderstood. They've said now that there has to be more than two-thirds going away and merging. The second part is forgotten by everybody, and merging to make a new party. So unless the whole thing goes, departs, and then merges with a new party, you do not have a defense to defection. So if you suppose, as is a live example in Shinde's case, Shinde counts about two-thirds as having left with him, but his party is not merged with any party.
That's right.
So it's a clear text in the 10th schedule if you read it. It requires a merger. It's been held by cases. But then lots of other Indian jugaad comes in to render that debate irrelevant, which we'll come to presently. I don't want to anticipate. But the law in a nutshell is that you need to depart over two-thirds and merge yourself and create a new entity. Otherwise, the defection law operates against you and there is no defense. If you create, however, a new entity by a merger, then it will not be called a defection. You're hardly ever seeing it happening.
That's right. So we'll come to this, one of these new strategies, which is going to the Election Commission and asking for the symbol, which is who is the real Shiv Sena, which is something that came up in Shinde's case. But before we do that, in your view, because we're just setting the ground and using the Shinde case as an example to set the ground, what in your view constitutes defection? Because here there is obviously the statement of law, which is voting against the party whip, unless there are some extenuating circumstances. But in the public perception, there are these unseemly scenes of resort politics, where in Shinde's case, there were these MLAs who were ferried to Guwahati, and you know, you all of them come in a bus to the governor, and they're kept cloistered, which all seems to be a mockery of democracy in some sense. So what, in your view, is an act that does constitute defection as per the 10th schedule and ought to constitute defection if you have a different point of view?
This is now pretty clearly clarified, amplified, elaborated, commented upon, analyzed by the Supreme Court in several judgments. But the bare text is also clear enough. You have broadly two species of defections. This is just broadly. There is an A in clause 2 and there is a B. So A is the simple phrases, if he has voluntarily given up his membership of such political party. It has to be the party. And it has to be if he has voluntarily given up. The second category is what is called the whip category. And it is drafted, if he votes or abstains from voting in such house, contrary to any direction issued by the political party to blah, 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 to which he belongs. Now, so there is a 2-1A defection, there's a 2-1B defection. Now, the debate normally centered around the first one. So what is voluntarily giving up membership? So the defenses in the early years were, look, so what? I supped and dined and sat on the podium with the rival party. That doesn't mean defection. You jolly well prove defection. So what? I went in a bus load of the opposition to make some complaint. I am entitled to complain because it's a democracy and I'm entitled to complain against my party. I want inner party reform or intra-party reform. I accompanied like-minded people to a destination and we discussed the problems in the country. That's not defection. Now, the conclusion or the consequence of each of these actions we all understand is toppling the government. And the classic way is to go in a group to the governor, where I join him, the opposite side, and go and complain. And that is an indication that you can photograph us, we are all standing there and numbers are here. So the court, in case after case after case, I won't bore you with the details, has now held that voluntarily giving up membership can be both explicit and implied. Principle number one. Number two, voluntarily giving up membership can be understood and inferred from the circumstance. You don't have to put a badge on your forehead saying, I have voluntarily given up membership. I don't have to take out an istihar that I have given up membership. Your holistic conduct can and is always liable to be interpreted. And they've held in a series of cases that, you know, to use the colloquial expression, supping and dining continuously in the context of anti-party statements with the opposition is defection. So that part has been clarified. Again, the problem is it takes time, so you get sometimes the benefits of your defection, but this is very clear as to what is 21A defection. 21B defection was always easier in any case, because 21B requires a direction by me. Mr. Sen Gupta, you must be present tomorrow and you must support so-and-so. And then they put three dark lines below. It's called the three-line whip. Mm. Or Mr. Sen Gupta, we're having a meeting and you have to attend. Now, that is an abstention clearly would be a defiance of that whip. That falls under 21B. That's a more easily, objectively testable condition. So the debate and the case law and the dispute was about the first one, which also now stands, I would say, almost entirely clarified.
So I'm deviating from the script that we agreed on a little bit, because there's one follow-up to this last point on 21B that I'd like to ask, which is that what does this whip do to parliamentary democracy? And the reason I ask this question is that the Constitution does not envisage political parties. Till it came to the 10th schedule, there's nothing in the Constitution. That word doesn't exist anywhere in the Constitution. It recognizes individual legislators who can exercise their vote in parliament. With the introduction of the whip, and if you vote against the whip, that you could be disqualified, it's become about the party. So what do you think that does to freedom of speech of a legislator in the assembly and this dynamic between the party and the individual, particularly in the context where there's lots of murmurs that we are actually a presidential form of government parading as a parliamentary system?
Well, you are asking a much larger question, which has a positive and a normative aspect, two separate aspects, and both are important. On the positive aspect, that is the law as it exists, we are a parliamentary democracy, good, bad or indifferent, we follow broadly a Westminster model. In the Westminster model, for several centuries, a whip has become part of convention, party practice, parliamentary practice, etc. I will come to the normative where I have very clear views, contrary to what you might think. But on the first part, a whip has been a part of parliamentary democracy very, very clearly, unlike, for example, the US, which has a different system. Now, it has been there for a variety of historical reasons, which we can't investigate today. But clearly, it is an inextricably intertwined part of British and Indian parliamentary democracy. So today, and secondly, people challenge the whip, by the way. It's not a new argument. People challenged because when the defection law came, nobody challenged the whip all these years. But when the anti-defection law came, people challenged it. And right in the first most famous case of this subject, Kihoto Holohan, they said that, look, this a whip may seem oppressive, may seem, but as it stands today, it is valid. It's a direction without which parties can't function. They need a certain amount of discipline, shepherding the flock, etc., etc. So it's been constitutionally upheld. Now, coming to the normative, I personally believe, and I've written articles on it, that it's time we reformed the whip. I have a nuanced argument and not an abolitionist argument, as some people say. Because abolishing a whip will lead to chaos. As long as you're a parliamentary democracy, you need discipline, you need organization, you need a certain. But we are now misusing the whip equally. I've written about it openly and I would like that to be changed by law. For anything and everything, you issue a whip. Today, it's an important day for more people to be shown, you must be present. And it's made a three-line, actually a three-line whip has lost its meaning because everything and everything leads to a three-line whip. So actually, what is the original purpose of a whip? That's where the reform will come from. The original purpose basically was that, look, the government should not fall because of the absence of a Sen Gupta or a Singhvi. And the government should not fall because of a cross-voting by a Sen Gupta or a Singhvi. That really is the bedrock purpose of the whip. I don't see any reason why you cannot reform the whip by law. Most political parties will otherwise not want to reform it without law. By simply saying that each person is free to vote and speak according to his, except in a narrow number of itemized cases, which may involve the falling of the government. Money bills, especially budgetary situations, would be one obvious example. Now, it's not going to be easy in the Indian context. It's a new culture we have to develop. But I think it's got another benefit. It's actually the very interesting model I've thought of sometimes of a mix and match of a basically parliamentary system which can have some of the benefits of a presidential system. You know, parliamentary creativity is quite remarkable, except that you only see the breaking of chairs and the jumping on the television cameras. But if you go on a lazy afternoon and sit in the chambers, you'll find some fantastic speech on agriculture being given by an unknown anonymous parliamentarian. You go on a lazy afternoon, you'll find a fantastic speech on something else because it comes from experience. Now, a lot of creativity, whips, negative point of whip is a lot of creativity is killed by the whip. The whip completely destroys creativity. Initiating arguments, voting or speaking in a free manner, merit-based, is all stultified by a whip. If you make a core list of matters where there is no chance other than those matters for a government falling, I don't see why the whip can't be reformed. It should be. So I'm giving you opposite answers for the positive and the normative.
That's right. And I think the normative one has a lot of food for thought, because I think as citizens and as concerned citizens, we must all look to make sure that the 10th schedule is ideally abolished, or if not abolished, then certainly significantly reformed. And I think this provides a template of how that reform can work itself out. Another area which has been controversial is the role of the speaker. Because as far as the 10th schedule is concerned, the 10th schedule vests significant powers in the speaker. In the Kyoto Holohan case, which Dr. Singhvi referred to, the Supreme Court said that the speaker is essentially a tribunal for the purpose of deciding disqualification petitions. And again, the Supreme Court in this Maharashtra case, kind of doubting in some sense its earlier judgment in Nabam Rabia, which was the Arunachal Pradesh case, said that the speaker should take a decision as soon as possible and should act as a repository of constitutional morality. Now, we've seen in Maharashtra and elsewhere, as Dr. Singhvi said, that speakers don't act in that manner, unfortunately, as a matter of course. There might be one or two exceptions here or there, but none in recent memory. So the question is that in terms of the role of the speaker, do you think that the Supreme Court in the Maharashtra case and in Kyoto, by reposing trust in the speaker, got something wrong? Or do you think that we need to think about an alternative model to the speaker himself or herself being the adjudicatory authority?
The speaker is the centerpiece of this system. And he's the weakest link of that system also. I'm sorry to say, but the time has come to either abolish what we call the persona designata of the 10th schedule. Unfortunately, the 10th schedule names a persona designata. So if the speaker falls ill or is not available, then nobody else can decide a 10th schedule matter, because the constitution names by position an entity called the speaker. And that has led over the years to a lot of abuse. Secondly, we are forgetting that a speaker is, in India at least, from inception, in some countries it's different, I'm going to tell you how, elected by a party. So I am not a speaker, I'm simply an MP, or in this case of assembly, an MLA, nominated by party X, and I stand from constituency Y. It is inconceivable in the current divisive context, and even for many decades earlier, to imagine that a speaker will become a paragon of virtue. Having got a ticket from party X, having fought an election against party Y, having been elected on that ticket, and then after becoming an MP or MLA, being elected as a speaker. That happens afterwards. So that very concept is flawed. It is a fond hope, an idle wish. It doesn't work in practice.
But surely there have been some speakers who defied that norm, even in your time.
Well, you know, in the 60s and the 50s, times were slower. Politics was not so divisive. And it is also a product of the times. After all, there was a majority party ruled for 20 years. Coalitions were hardly known. Coalition governance in India has got structurally embedded only from 1991. Politics has become very fractious. We have fractured mandates even for a statute, forget a constitutional amendment. So in a fractured, divisive, polarized atmosphere, I don't think it's been more polarized ever before than we are now seeing. Good, bad, or indifferent, not the point. It is absolutely ridiculous to expect the speaker to be non-partisan. It is actually, you know, asking him to be beyond divine. And he's not even human, leave aside beyond divine. So the question is, what do you do about it? In the very, very old days, there are some precedents where, and that I think should be tried, you decide in advance that you are going to set up a person as a speaker. And once you decide he's given a constituency, because he has to be elected, and no party should put up a candidate against him. That's the answer. I believe in practical answers, no point sermonizing.
Who decides?
All the parties together decide that there has to be one speaker. We want a genuinely non-partisan. So we decide that this person, see, after all, when they are elected, people understand more or less that he's the senior most chap, he should be speaker. Now, in the beginning, you can decide that a person who's generally a statesman like Ivich, but the condition has to be an agreement, even in a fractious atmosphere, a convention has to be developed, or even law by constitutional amendment, that you decide that from Chhatarpur, Mr. X will stand and no other party will put up a candidate in Chhatarpur. That gives a huge strength to that position. Then you can have a man as an adjudicator. But since you'll never do it, since it'll never happen, abolish the 10th schedule. Create an independent constitutional regulatory commission like the EC. Not the EC, something like that, to decide defections. Because today, as you rightly said, you know, all the speakers' decisions inside the House, be it Assembly or Parliament, are not challengeable. There are articles which say that they are beyond the judicial review. That's because right. He's a master of his own house. Just like you cannot look into the house of the court, the court can't look into the house of the speaker. But the same speaker is then put in the 10th schedule where he's clearly a tribunal. He's just like a railway rates tribunal or a TDSAT tribunal. Now, it's a tightrope walk which hardly any speaker I know of in states or central can ever be expected to do. So therefore, my suggestion is, stop this, figments of imagination and deeming fictions which lawyers love to use. Stop the sermonizing. You start having either a elected, consensually pre-elected speaker, I would say. Consensually pre-elected, which is not very difficult, by the way. It can be done. It will make us a very proud democracy. Or simply create a new regulatory commission, very much like the 10th schedule, but taking it away from the persona designata, which is the speaker.
Sure, and I think this is what you hit upon really is a problem of lack of independence in certain constitutional authorities. And it was also telling that I think this is only in the last, maybe in the last 5 years or so that we've started talking. Even we can't even talk about the EC as a fully independent institution.
No, and he's got an umbilical cord with his mother.
That's right.
Now, umbilical cord, you not only cut, you say go and revolt against the mother.
That's right. It's a double whammy.
It happen in the real life.
And so I think that brings me nicely to the question of the Election Commission, which is intrinsically linked with the question of defection through a new strategy that has been devised, which is that instead of merging with another party or splitting, you go to the EC, say that I am the real party, right? So this is what happens in Maharashtra, that Eknath Shinde revolts against Uddhav Thackeray, goes to the EC and says that the symbol of the bow and arrow which belongs to the Shiv Sena should be given to me because I am the real Shiv Sena. And that matter gets decided very quickly and Eknath Shinde gets the bow and arrow. The matter relating to disqualification remains pending because of a stay by the Supreme Court. And so the real Shiv Sena is now the Eknath Shinde Sena. So here, in terms of the perception for the common man, this is a very absurd situation that has transpired because the Supreme Court has given a judgment in Shinde's case saying that the governor calling for a floor test for Uddhav Thackeray to prove his majority in a floor test is unconstitutional, but we can't do anything about it because he has resigned and so we can't ask him to come back. And in the interim, this matter relating to the symbols as to who has the right symbol is a different matter, which is now in appeal before a different bench in the Supreme Court. That will be determined in its time, but our hands are tied. So what do you say about this new strategy of this parallel track of going to the Election Commission? Can't we just bring both of these tracks
so
together?
Let's try and simplify this for a relatively lay audience. And this is the worst part of the decoding defection subject. This is really the worst part. Never happened. This particular part, which you're now talking about, has happened only in the last 4 or 5 years. In 75 years of Indian independence, it hasn't happened for 70 years. And what is this? This is conflating two unrelated issues to get a result. So first point to be made here is that ultimately you have to not lament, not only explain this, but you have to see this happens because institutions are debased and devalued. If you have an independent election commission, why should you be bothered? If you have an independent, set of individual, persons looking into its speaker or benches of the court, you wouldn't really bother about it. Today, this conflation succeeds because of lack of independence, and I would say also lack of that institutional integrity to which we expect our institutions to look up. What happens? Before you come to the Maharashtra example you are referring, there is a worse example which has happened after Maharashtra, which also I've done, the Sharad Pawar example. Now, there are three or four things which have to be disentangled. Today, the NCP, which is the one in power, decides to defect. You have to understand that as laymen. Now, they know that this is clear defection because there's no merger. In that case, it may not be even two-thirds, so by the real letter of the law. So now you think of the third Indian Jugaad to prevent defection. So one day before you leave, you file a small little complaint in the EC. In this case, actually it happened. Nobody even knew about the complaint. They just put a letter or a petition saying that this is a symbols petition. There is a clause called 15 in a symbols order. Symbols order is not statute, not Act of Parliament, not constitution. It's just a rule taken out by the EC. The owner of that, the producer of that is the EC. So that's the old symbols order, which says that that party which has a majority shall be given the symbol and be recognized as the party. Now, that time, we didn't even have the 10th schedule when they created this. 10th schedule, folks in India have found out this Jugaad only recently. So it goes there, it's pending there. Meanwhile, this thing starts. Now, here, if you have a friendly speaker, he delays the disqualification decision. While it is delayed, the EC is persuaded to hotfoot that decision. Now, you understand my words, persuaded to hotfoot. I should not be using these words, but this happens. That's the meaning of debasing and devaluing institutions. EC hotfoots it, hears, and then gives a judgment saying, I award the symbol to him. Using that decision, the speaker says, ab to real party ye hai. Now, just see what happens here. Pause. And the Supreme Court has corrected it, but in a futile correction. When there is a symbols application, the normal test is a threefold test. The organizational party has to be seen, the legislative party has to be seen, and the overall support has to be seen. So a political party may have only 20 MLAs or 20 MPs, but it may have millions of people in the organization. Those millions continue to support, I'm giving an example because I appeared for him, but I mean, don't misunderstand me, Sharad Pawar. But those 20, 18 have defected from the house with the other, what is that, Ajit Pawar's faction. So the EC says that I recognize it, and it applies amazingly in many cases the legislative test. Now here is a third whammy. The legislative test you are applying on the basis of defection. Where is the question of legislative test? Because the legislation is based on defection. And you are giving very fake reasons for the organizational test is flawed, as the EC has done in two orders, because the intra-party elections were not good. Now, the intra-party elections happened earlier. The persons who have defected relied on the intra-party elections, held the post of vice president, general secretary on those elections, never challenged it. But after defecting, they say, the original intra-party elections were bad, so apply the legislative test. And conveniently, the EC applies legislative. And the legislative test is what? It is a test based on defections. So the Supreme Court in Shinde, which you mentioned, I'm coming back from what happened here to the judgment. There's only one judgment on this yet, Shinde's case, where the Chief Justice, the current Chief Justice, delivered a thumping judgment and wrote all the law and said that in such cases, first and foremost, the application of the legislative test itself is suspect. You can normally have a legislative test, but when the legislative majority is pure, it's real. You can't have a legislative test when it's a defected majority. So you should consider the organizational test. But those are only rhetorical sermons because at the ground level, by then, the people who had become the party, who had got the symbol, who had joined the government, who had become ministers. In the Shinde case, you've made another fourth point, which is the part of what I call an erroneous part. The judgment is otherwise right. The erroneous part is, see, I moved it in June of 21, I think it was, or 22. It was a holiday period. At that time, the Supreme Court issued a notice and said, we can't stay it. You have the legislative floor test and you come back on next week. Now, for whatever emotional reason, political reason, to make a declaration in the political arena, Uddhav Thackeray declared that he will not face a test by defectors. He doesn't want to stand. I want to ask a question. How can the judgment, which it does, suggest that because you never took a floor test, therefore, we cannot reverse status quo.
And a floor test that is unconstitutional.
Two are unconnected.
That's right.
You see, the floor test is a political game. I may or may not take. But the challenge is to the original defection. If that defection is bad, which is held to be bad, the root is bad, how can the flower be kosher? So that is the error.
That's right.
Now, whatever it is, and by the way, when I appeared on the first day in the interim, I asked the court to stay the floor test. The court says no stay. The court says do the floor test. And then that floor test which is not stayed is become the basis of denying relief after holding the defection to be invalid.
That's right. Absolutely.
So look at the whole rigmarole. So, you know, there's a saying in Latin, ibi ius, ibi remedium. You should not have rights without remedies. Because the right becomes a peric right, becomes an ornamental right. So this is an example of ibi ius, ibi remedium, ibi no remedium.
And what does this do? Actually, it's great that you pointed this out because I've also written on it that the problem with the judgment is the fact that it says all the right things, but the relief doesn't follow as a result of that. So what does this do actually to the act of resignation? Because if I were a politician looking at this, then I would say that come what may, never resign, right? Because if you resign, then in that case, the Supreme Court will hold against you and say that you voluntarily resign. But resignation is, of course, seen as the ultimate act of taking some moral responsibility, one of the last kind of vestiges of some principle in politics. And so what do you think this judgment does in terms of that signaling effect to politicians who may be on the verge of resignation?
So there are two facets of resignation, one which you mentioned, but let me mention first another one. Another facet of resignation topples governments. So, if you have less than a majority in a house, in our parliamentary Westminster system, merely abstention reduces the strength of this room. So, if 20 people don't attend, the strength of the voting becomes from 100 to 80. And all those attend, their vote value increases. They were earlier only 40 out of 100. But when 21 people don't attend, they become 41 out of 80 or 79. Now, abstention, therefore, is a very clever way and a repeated way of, so if I approach you with inducements or blandishments, I say simply, aap abstain kariye, and therefore I make a majority. The other form of this is that if you are charged with disqualification, you resign. Mm. Maximum to hum disqualify ho rahe hain, hum resign kar dete hain, kya problem hai? I am the wrongdoer.
That's right.
But your resignation, your departure, your abstention has already toppled the government. In the new government, you become a minister.
That's right.
Without fighting election. Because you have 6 months in which you can get elected. This is happening, by the way. This is not my imagination, febrile or fertile. This is happening. You simply resign. The party which comes to power has promised you. You can't wait because political promises are not permanent. So you become a minister now, 6 months ago, seat nikal ke elect ho jao gaya. So one of the reforms obviously has to be that if you are a defector who has resigned, then without re-election, you cannot come back into government. Don't take advantage of the 6 month period.
That's right.
So these are all, the other part you asked about resignation is that, a resignation is mainly used for creating different numbers or abstentions. It doesn't have any much other value except that you can just make sure that a much reduced minority becomes a majority. So that is something which you need to curb by law because, you know, these are things which our founders, I mean, actually I wrote in that article which is serialized in Indian Express and a Marathi counterpart of Indian Express. It comes every 3-4 weeks that Gayalal will be blushing today. Gayalal never thought of half or one-tenth of these jugaads.
That's right.
I mean, Gayalal would say, I am an innocent child in the woods, if you heard of these. So this is the point.
That's right. This the entire issue of defection seems to be primarily an issue of political morality and decency. That you've been voted into power by somebody because you've belonged to a particular party and now you've completely switched over. Now, in this context, I wanted to ask you about the limits of the law. Do you think that the law as an instrument can really look to quell what is essentially a debasement of political morality in India today?
It's a truism. Law, you cannot legislate morality. It's It's as simple as that. You cannot legislate morality. I mean, we have borrowed, inherited this system from where? From England. How many defections do you hear of in England? As a matter of fact, I'm surprised. The differences are overarching. You know, in the House of Commons, they sit very close to each other and they attack as if they're going to go at each other's throats. But with huge differences in your own party, you fight your own prime minister, you become a candidate. I have not seen or heard of a defection for ages. And I'm sure if a chap defects, he will be unelectable. So the first point in answer to your question is, first point is, of course, you can't legislate morality. Second is, it is you who are responsible, I who am responsible. You elect, re-elect and re-re-elect the defector.
That's right.
England doesn't. So the message is clear that you don't reward defections. So this has to come, what might be, you know, little elitist to call it a more maturer democracy as education grows, as this grows. Or at the moment, the best thing is to create a separate independent regulatory commission. Of course, it has the flaw that we have so many so-called independent bodies which have not always been independent. So that problem will remain. But at least the 10th schedule and the speaker, unless at least you do the, what I'm saying, a pre-elected consensual speaker, is absolutely not what the paper is written on.
That's right. And I think it really calls for some real ideology in our politics. And the reason why a Tory will not become a Labour Party candidate is because they just belong to different worldviews. And here...
In America, it's the other way. It's another interesting nuance. Republicans will not become Democrats easily. Hardly any examples. But Republicans and Democrats will vote bipartisan because of the lack of whip in a presidential system. They will vote on issues. That's a different issue. But this changing of party, and mind you, there are only two parties. England has more parties.
That's right.
Is unheard of.
That's right.
Because at the end of the day, people believe that the electorate will punish you. That can be the only answer. Unless you believe that, why will you not defect?
Yeah, as it was said, where you stand on an issue depends on where you sit. I think this is very true, certainly in India. So last question from me. You've written in your Indian Express article on several reforms that the law needs. You've spoken about a few. But in the interests of completeness, how do you think, if you were in that position to reform the 10th schedule, what are, apart from the role of the speaker, which you have talked about, and the regulatory commission, what are the key changes that you would bring to where we are today, from where we are today?
No, changes I have more or less outlined, and I'll only repeat them in a summary fashion, without any illusions of whether I have the power to do it. One, you have to change this whole role of the speaker. I would prefer a pre-elected consensual speaker. You'll find a sea change in thinking. You'll find a sea change in morality. It sounds absurd, but it's something we should try. It requires no legislation, by the way.
That's right.
Virtually none. Alternatively, you create a very high-powered constitutional commission. I don't know how high-powered, with people who are statesmen who will decide these matters. Third, you plug these silly loopholes that I can resign, become a minister, and enjoy for 6 months just having defected two weeks earlier. Fourth, you must plug the other loophole of running to the EC when your defection is hot and valid. You must change this symbols order clause 15, or you must create a interrelationship between the 10th schedule and the symbols order. Imagine the symbols order, which is not even a statute, it is less than a rule, is governing a constitutional chapter called 10th schedule.
That's right.
Look at the irony. It's happening in every case. So these are four or five things, if you really want to. And remember, you have to also decide frankly. If you see the debates, Ashok Sen moved the bill in 84. Rajiv Gandhi had got 400 and something seats. This was moved then. Everybody agreed, and this phrase has been used by case after case, you first decide whether it's a constitutional sin or not. If you decide it's not a constitutional sin, but merely an infraction, then don't be holistic, don't be sermonizing and very, you know, holier than thou about it, then forget about it. You don't need to have anti-defection law. But if you believe that it's a constitutional sin, that's the phrase used 1 million times from 1984 onwards by case law, by parliament, by those who moved the bill, those who amended the bill, then you are really saying, look, it's a constitutional sin, but chalta hai, kya kare? There's no answer to that. You have to deal with it then.
Yep. It's unfortunately difficult to imagine that sinners will undo the constitutional sins that we have. But I think this is certainly wisdom for a future day that we have to, that hopefully at some point of time we will have a better defection law.
As we close today, it's time for Free and Fair, our special audience poll. This is where, as the listener, you get to exercise your franchise. Our question today, is the 10th schedule of the Constitution of India in its current form enough to stop defection? Vote yes or no. And to cast your vote, visit my Twitter account at @orgo_justify. You have 48 hours. Adjourn.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, follow us on Twitter at @Vidhi_India for regular updates. We are on SoundCloud and Spotify as Vidhi Center for Legal Policies podcast. You can also listen to us on Google Podcasts or iTunes. Email us at justify@vidhilegalpolicy.in to share your comments and feedback on this episode.